exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous guest. I'm really happy, finally, from the way from Toronto, my hometown. Calvin Campbell's here, his new film Receiver. As always, you got to wait to the end to find out where to find out, because you got to listen how good he talks. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start off. I mean, your background must have helped you making this film so much.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, there's this specific background for me, being Sri Lankan Canadian, that informed the choice when we were writing Receiver to make the main character Sri Lankan Canadian. It helped a lot of the thematic concerns we were going with, but for me, there was also just simply the matter that, well, there's not a lot of Sri Lankan Canadians in the media. I mean, even here in Toronto, which not a lot of people realize is, in fact, like, basically the largest center of the Sri Lankan diaspora in the world. Like, outside of Sri Lanka, you will find the most Sri Lankans, you know, collated together in one place here in Toronto. But even here, there's still very few Sri Lankans and Sri Lankan Canadians that are in the media. So, in a way, the direction we chose to take Receiver by actively making the main character Sri Lankan Canadian was also partly for me a response to that and a way to explore my own heritage a little bit.
Well, that's great. Now let's go a little bit more deeper. I mean, the sound is wonderful. I want to get right into the sound. Your ADR was amazing.
Well, that's the interesting thing. There is not a single line of ADR in the film.
Really? So that's all done live. I'm impressed.
All done live. So that was a pretty primary consideration for me right off the bat, knowing that the film was going to be driven so much by the main character, Sriani, who is on screen by herself, and that all of the other characters in the film are solely heard via the telephone. I knew it was going to be really important to have the most robust strategy to record sound, not just for the sake of getting a good sonic recording, but also for the sake of making sure that the actors would have the best possible relationship within the use of their voices and their interaction. And so I fought pretty hard from the beginning that we would actually have all of the off-screen actors live on set when we were shooting. They were all located just off-set and recorded live so that there could be this direct one-to-one interaction between Tahereh Veshdani, who is our lead actress, and all the other performers in the film.
Well, that was an awesome idea. Like, I'm just so shocked the clarity of everything. I was like, wow, I didn't have to turn up my volume. I think people could enjoy it. I find with a lot of independent films, that's one of the biggest problems is the sound. Like, you don't get that clear sound, and it's just phenomenal. I also want to, where did you find your lead actress? I like the look of her. And it's not like, wow, she's beautiful. I'm not saying she isn't, but I'm saying this looks like a real person doing this job. Like, it looks like she just walked out and sitting at home and doing her job. And she, I guess what I'm trying to say, she doesn't look like an actor, which is what I don't want to see in films usually. I see too much of that. I like to see somebody that can act without knowing how to act is what I'm trying to say. Looks like they're supposed to.
Absolutely. And I think that's hugely to Tahereh's credit as a performer. A lot of that facility you're seeing with her fitting into the role that she's playing comes down to the huge amount of very specific and very precise research that she did leading up to the film. And what was great was she actually had a pretty clear in to begin research into the job of a telephone social worker, because my girlfriend Stephanie is in fact a social worker. When my co-writer Luke Higginson and I started writing the film, Stephanie was working at a telephone helpline, so we pulled a lot of inspiration for her own experiences, both good and frustrating, working in an environment like that when we were writing the film. And then Stephanie basically served as sort of an expert witness for Tahereh. I know they had a couple of research sessions together where they got the chance to talk through Steph's experiences, her thoughts about the job, the position that she's in, doing a role like that, that can be so fraught, but in a sense so fractured that you're dealing with these very, very heavy issues. involving people who are oftentimes in crisis, but you don't have a personal and a tactile experience of being directly in front of that person, because you constantly have this dividing wall of this telephonic limitation between you and this person who is oftentimes pouring their heart out to you. So Tara had a great chance, I think, to talk to Stephanie about her own experiences doing the job. And I think that that really hugely influenced Tara's ability to you know, end up on screen, exactly as you said, feeling like a person, less so an actor, you know?
Now, how is writing with somebody? Do you find that difficult at times, or you just accept them and say, no, maybe you're right on this point?
It can be difficult at times because, of course, there's times we don't see eye to eye on things. We knew, and I should start by saying, Luke Higginson, my co-writer on this, he and I have known each other for almost 20 years. We've worked together in several different capacities. Luke is also a director and a picture editor, and I've worked with him on several projects. This is the first one that we've actually collaborated in the writing on, but it's certainly not our first collaboration. So that certainly helped a lot, that we know each other rather well. Yeah, inevitably there ends up being issues where you disagree on things, but the deal we came up with early on was that we knew that this was going to be something I was directing. So the deal that we made is ultimately that if it comes down to a disagreement, I get veto rights on it, because I'm the one who has to find a way to direct it, so I've got to have maybe slightly more influence on the direction of the script. And for a future project that we've got in the works where the roles are going to reverse, that we're going to co-write it and Luke is going to direct it, I've already accepted that he gets the veto rights. When we disagree, he gets to tell me to shut up.
That's awesome. Location is very difficult sometimes for an independent filmmaker and try to find the right thing. Why'd you pick this apartment over other ones?
Well, that's a bit of a trick question, because this is actually a set we shot in studio.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that nice set. A very good job.
Thank you. I need to definitely shout out my production designer, Jennifer Tam. She and I had an incredible working experience on this film. It was the first time that she and I had worked together. But a huge amount of the direction and texture of that set is entirely to her credit.
So I want to get into set design here. Then you had me fooled. It 100% looks like an apartment. You have clutter. You have everything in the right place. So how long does it take you to set up that scene then? Because you're already filming for, what, a week at this location?
Oh, God, I wish we had a week. We had 3 days to film with. But we had, I should say, because we were in a studio and because we were building the set, we had about a week and a half of prep before that. Okay. I should say prep specifically for the art direction and the set work and the lighting and things like that. So, the process began for the actual designing of the set months before, with a huge amount of collaboration between myself and Jennifer and my director of photography, John Tarver, as well as Luke Higginson, who is also the editor of this film, as well as the co-writer. I tend to be pretty precise when it comes to building a shot list for a film that I'm directing, and especially for a film that is as technically complex as Receiver, with a lot of high and low angle shots. We knew that everything had to be designed very carefully so that we wouldn't be overbuilding or underbuilding the set. In essence, the goal being, we don't want to build an entire room. We don't want to build an entire apartment, because quite simply, that's very expensive. So the goal was to, months before we would set up that first plank of wood, have a very clear and very precise idea of where am I going to need to look, what corners are going to be important, what are we going to see, what are we not going to see, so that we could tailor the size of the set specifically to just what the camera is going to see. And then as far as filling in the details and adding texture, then a lot of that comes with Jennifer's instincts once we get the general dimensions and the general geography of the set built and, like, built digitally, in the CAD program we were using to design it. Then she comes in with her crew and they just go to town for a week, getting everything in place. And then I obviously have some input on the choice for dressings and things like that. And the one specific thing, it was a rule that we walked into this with, was specifically about the authenticity of the Sri Lankan art and artifacts, which is that we had made a rule very early on that unless we could accurately line up the provenance of a piece as being specifically Sri Lankan, it could not be on the set. Because I was very clear that I did not want to end up in a position that we ended up dressing the set with very general South Asian influenced art pieces, because the main character's Sri Lankan background is so important to the undercurrents that inform the film, I was very clear that everything had to be authentic. And a lot of that art actually came from stuff that's owned by me and my mom and other members of our family. All the photos on the walls are actually all authentic family photos from family, my family in Sri Lanka. All the art is actually from Sri Lanka. It was all purchased over the years, going back to, you know, some heirlooms from the Second World War that we had that came with my mom's family to Canada when they immigrated in the 60s. So.
I'm impressed then. So your high and low shots, does that give you the camera depth? Because you definitely go outside of your room a few times. Not that you're really outside, but I can see an outside window, which I have to see that. And then you bring it, you show me the floor, you show me walls. So is that your idea of giving me depth? Or was that your whole plan? I mean, I'm sure the set's not as big as I think it is just by seeing the film.
Yeah, partly it's obviously to fill in the audience's expectation of the room and make it feel real. My personal view of it is that the worst thing you can kind of do as a director, if you want to make the room feel real outside the edges of the camera lens, is to simply shoot at eye level close-ups of your actors, because you could have an incredible real location that you're shooting in. If you just get the camera directly at eye level, right in their face, and spend the entire scene there, it could be a set. You know, there's all of the production design, all of the world building that you've done visually, all gets lost unless you actually make some choices to see some of the room and to fill in those details for the audience. So that was certainly part of it. Specifically doing all the high and low angle stuff, though, a lot of that was influenced by what I wanted to say tonally in terms of the genre. We were really hugely influenced by a lot of the horror and psychological thriller films of the 1970s, early 1980s, especially the work of Robert Altman and Brian De Palma. And in those eras, both of those guys were using a lot of, you know, off-axis shooting in order to constantly set up this friction between pictorial reality and internal psychological states for their characters. And knowing that we had one performer who was going to be on screen, in essence, carrying the entire film by herself, I knew that I needed to ultimately unlock every possible tool at my disposal to be getting the audience to identify with Sriani's emotional point of view. And a lot of that was about starting to get a little weird and a little off axis with the shooting as you know, her objective point of view of the events happening in the scene starts to fracture.
I do going to draw for one set piece I want to discuss. You have a birthday balloon in the background. Does the gold symbolize anything, or is just that's the only one balloon you wanted?
You're halfway there.
I didn't want to go too far because I don't want to ruin it for people, so I'm kind of just being easy.
Well, there is ultimately a lot of rather clear sort of symbolism that comes out in terms of what happens with the balloons and how they shift over the course of the film.
Yes.
In terms of the color, though, no, that wasn't an active choice. In fact, we didn't want to use the gold color, but for that size of inflatable letter balloon, that is literally the only color that they come in. that was available to us. There were more colors, but the option for the letter balloons that had more larger color palette, the letters were huge and they were entirely wrong for the space and the level of subtlety we wanted to have to what shifts with the balloons over the course of the film. So as far as the gold goes, I can't claim credit for that. That was literally just a choice that was made for us by the manufacturer of the balloon.
You do have a certain set piece that does a lot of work for you throughout the film.
Well, now I don't even know which one you're talking about.
It's on a wall. Like, it's on the wall.
Yeah, absolutely.
People listening, where I'm showing a prop just not to ruin anything for you guys. Was that mainly CGI, or did you have that painted, or did you have that already?
Ready? No, that was actually a piece painted. It's an original oil painting painted by a local artist named Saya Yang, who I met about 8 months before we started prepping the film. I saw her work at the Riverdale Art Walk, which is just down the street from where I live in Toronto. And I was really struck by, it's a little bit cliched to refer to an artist's vision, but the way that her canvases sort of looked out on the world and the way that she realized these sort of imaginary spaces with an amount of like real pictorial texture, if I'm explaining myself in a foolish way, really struck me. And so that was a piece that I found there that I kept coming back to as I was circling the artist booths at the art walk. And I said, well, I need to buy this. I don't know what it's for, but I need to buy this from her. And as she and I got to talking later, after I'd already purchased the canvas, it really just sort of clicked to me that it would be a great sort of centerpiece totally for what we were going to be trying to do in a couple of months with the film.
So the script was already written before the canvas was purchased?
Correct. Yeah.
Wow. So you lucked out there.
Admittedly, we did shift some of Drake's dialogue to interlock a little better with the canvas after that. But all of the general sort of metaphorical and thematic language that Drake uses over the course of his telephone conversation with Sriani was all in the original script.
Okay.
So that's probably part of one of the reasons why seeing Saya's canvas originally just leapt out at me, even though I couldn't place why it was so haunting for me, but because I guess it interlocked quite well with a lot of the visual metaphors that were already swimming around my head at that point.
So, your main character has a costume change at one point. Was another color ever acknowledged, or we're always going with that certain color?
No, the dress was always going to be red. It was written into the script from the first draft.
Well, I didn't want to say what color. I thought so.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was trying to be nice. I do want to discuss the music, but I have one last question which you don't want to answer. You don't have to, because I know it's kind of a... There's a certain scene that an edible is being eaten at some kind. Did you ever play with the amount of that item being eaten?
Yes, we did, because there are numerous very amusing outtakes for me that we didn't end up using in the final film. Just with that scene and the use of that prop. So yeah, we played around quite a bit with it. It was actually the last, short of the dream sequence imagery, which was shot a completely separate day with no actors. That was actually the last scene that we filmed for Receivers. And it was the very last shot that we did, because we knew the wardrobe that Tara is wearing in that moment was going to get messy. So we knew we had to save it for the very end. So we got to cut loose and have a bit of fun. But yeah, there was a bit of play in how we filmed that.
See, I think we've done good. Let's discuss the music. I think you definitely play with emotions a lot with that music throughout this. And it's always subtle. I don't find it's ever overpowering.
Yeah, well, the conversations that I originally had with my composer, Deanna Choi, were always designed around the idea of subtlety and how subtlety could work if we're talking about a horror film. Because, of course, subtlety when it comes to music, and because music is one of the areas in filmmaking, you know, where you can have ultimately the freest hand in being a little more forward with playing your themes literally on your sleeve for the audience. So obviously the question of what makes a subtle score varies quite widely between genres. So she and I talk quite a lot about, well, what does subtlety mean if we're talking about a psychological horror film that is entirely inside the emotional point of view of a young immigrant woman? And one of the big considerations that was actually Deanna's suggestion was that we not work within the realm of leitmotif. So we don't have themes or thematic lines that get musically attached to each individual character, because she felt that for the length of the film, and I completely agree with this choice creatively, that to do so would ultimately have made the music feel quite fractured, because it's a 15-minute film. You don't have a lot of room to jump around between different themes. So what she had suggested and what I told her to run with was the idea that basically Suriani's emotions would be the theme. There would be one musical motif for the film, and it would be, what does Suriani feel internally at any given point in this film? And so that really allowed us to create a really direct passage to, you know, how do we move from the slower, more heartfelt material into some of the creepier stuff, into some of the darker stuff? At what point do we want the audience to be confused with what the music is trying to suggest? And that was always, well, the music should seem to differ from pictorial reality around the times that Suriani is confused herself about what is going on. So I think it was a really smart idea. And ultimately what it meant was we basically had no themes in the film, because the entire score is basically one 15-minute long theme that is constantly shifting based on the emotional color of the main character.
Fair enough. I'm going to wrap this up with your fun questions, if you're ready.
I'm ready. Hit me.
It's your first time being on my show. I have to ask, always your favorite film?
Oh, God. That is such a cheap question to ask a director.
I know it is.
Because I'm going to have to tell you two, because I don't have one favorite film. I have two that are tied for the top spot.
Yeah, let's hear them.
Blade Runner and Lawrence of Arabia.
Two beautiful. Oh, wow. All cinematography films right there.
Well, the interesting thing that has kind of followed me around almost my entire career is that the films, since starting to make films myself, that have come to be my favorites and the ones that I keep coming back to and constantly seek inspiration from, even if I'm making a project that doesn't line up in terms of genre or tone with the film, those films, and there's like probably 10 of them, are films that I uniformly hated the first time I saw them. I didn't understand, hated them, found them boring, whatever the answer was. Every one of the films that I would say are for me, professionally, within my top 10, are all films that I had to come around to, kind of, I don't want to say painfully, but that there was ultimately a process of attrition, I think, in my relationship to those films, which is probably the reason they continue to inspire me, simply because I can still, even now, after having seen Lawrence of Arabia probably over 40 times,
oh, wow,
I can still, every time I watch it, I still get something new about it.
Well, I'm going to have to ask, are we watching the 4-hour cut or are we watching the theatrical cut?
I am absolutely watching the full cut of it.
Oh, wow, man, that is a long, that's a great film. I've seen the 4-hour cut. Okay, now I want this to be specific. Your favorite male on your set?
My favorite meal?
On your set.
Ooh. Now, hold on. I need to ask, do you mean like favorite meal that we ate as part of catering when we were shooting the film?
That is correct. That's exactly my question.
Okay. Well, all right. I'm going to cheat because it wasn't actually catered, but it was the cake.
Okay. That's fair.
That was sort of our cheeky kind of celebration was that the prop cake got served to the key members of the crew. Anybody who wanted to try it after we finished, that was probably my favorite because it was definitely imbued with something interesting by the point it got to us.
Fair enough. Because you're an independent filmmaker, I always like to ask advice for other directors coming up. You're listening to this interview. What advice could you give a first-time filmmaker?
That's a really tough question to answer because, frankly, the film industry right now in Canada is not very healthy. It is a very difficult period to be an independent filmmaker and a very painful period, if I'm being honest, to be a filmmaker. I mean, admittedly, it's painful to be an independent filmmaker wherever you live. But for me, working in Canada and being Canadian, it's especially painful here because I love this country, but it is a country that does not value its artists, unfortunately, until they are discovered in other countries and propped up by other people.
So, that's correct.
I guess the single stringer of advice I could give to somebody who's thinking, perhaps rather foolishly, about launching into this as a career it's an issue of persistence. It is, you know, to use a hoary old cliche, it is a marathon, not a sprint. Some people, like, our media is ultimately filled with stories of people who hit it big their first or the second time out of the gate. Filmmakers such as, for instance, Xavier Dolan, right? Who, that was a great story that everybody got a lot of traction about, this 18-year-old Quebecois filmmaker opening his first feature in Cannes. That is so outside of the realm of possibility for most of us, but it's completely understandable why that's what the media talks about. It's a great story. It's a headline that gets people to read. But it is not the reality. And people who are starting out need to both understand that and be prepared for it to be a long slog. You ultimately have to be your own best support. And a lot of the time you have to find the ways to provide yourself with the support that you need to make your work when nobody else is there prepared to do it. In the case of Receiver, and this was after, you know, my last film, Hangnail, opened Park City and won a bunch of awards. After Hangnail was released, I was down in LA taking meetings with Bad Robot, which is J.J. Abrams' company. And I came back to Canada and I couldn't get a film financed here for 8 years after doing that. Every single proposal that I submitted in a period of 8 years after Hangnail was released got turned down. And when we were developing Receiver, we spent about a year and a half trying to get the film financed, and we got turned down by literally every public and private fund that we are eligible for in North America.
Wow.
And so in the end, I decided if this film was going to happen, I have to finance it myself. And so that's what I did. Obviously, you don't want to do that. That doesn't feel like the way that it should have to be every time, because the whole gag is that if a film is going to be successful independently, it's not successful because it pays you money back. It is successful because it theoretically makes it slightly easier to get the next film made. But that is not really the case in Canada these days. Like, it certainly wasn't the case with me. If anything, I think Receiver was a harder film to make after the success of Hangnail than it might have been if I were a complete nobody. So I guess that's my long-winded way of saying you've got to be ready to invest yourself into a project, knowing that there is a very distinct possibility that nobody else will in this country. And what that ultimately means is you've got to love it. You can't embark, I don't believe, successfully on any film project anymore in the current climate in Canada if you don't love it, because it is going to take everything from you.
That has got to be the best answer I've ever heard on this show, because I 100% agree with everything you said. Before I let you go, tell everybody where they can find your film. I know it's in the festival run. Where's it going after that?
Well, its premiere is happening on November 12th at 10 a.m. at the Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. Real Asian runs from the 12th to the 19th, and Receiver is screening every day through that week of the festival. And the cool thing is, myself and Tara are actually taking part in a live Q&A that's happening at 10 a.m. on November 15th. That's open to all ticket holders. So that's where we'll be seen currently. And those tickets are available across the country. Real Asian, because they're going entirely digital this year, their screenings are available to anybody in Canada, from sea to shining sea. And otherwise on the internet, you can find me at interlockpictures.com, which is my website. On Facebook and Instagram, I'm at Interlock Pictures. And you can find my musings on Twitter at CCam Operator. And as for future festivals after Real Asian, we've got a couple we think are coming down the pipe, but nothing that we can quite announce just yet.
Fair enough. Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon. This was a lot of fun.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page. Thank you.